Pakistan soon after she made the list. U.S. officials say the next time they saw her was when she was arrested in Afghanistan on July 17th. A boy was with her when she was taken into custody, and then he too seemed to go missing. Now federal prosecutors say they believe that boy is in U.S. custody. The FBI is doing a DNA test to see if he is her son, Ahmed Siddiqui. Ahmed Siddiqui is an American citizen. He was born here. All that is certain in this case is that Afia Siddiqui is now in New York. She was brought here after she allegedly shot at an Army captain who tried to question her at an Afghan police station. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, New York.
And I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Chevy. 8 models with 30 mpg on the highway, including Cobalt XFE Coupe with 36, based on EPA estimates. Chevy.com.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
The U of I campus was transformed after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941. Join us for an evening of music, video, and discussion of what life was like then through the eyes of 5 U of I alums. Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center, 601 South Lincoln Avenue in Urbana. This WILL-sponsored event is free and open to the public. More information at our website, will.illinois.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will be talking about what some would consider one of the most significant foreign policy failures of the Bush administration, and that is the failure to prevent North Korea from becoming a nuclear weapons state. When George Bush became president, North Korea's nuclear program was at a standstill, but in the years since, Pyongyang has accumulated enough material to make as many as 10 warheads and has conducted a test. How did the administration, with a foreign policy built around preventing countries like North Korea from developing nuclear weapons, fail so dramatically? This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, our guest is Mike Chinoy. He is the Edgerton Fellow on Korean Security at the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles. And for many years, he has reported on Asia. He worked for CNN for 24 years. He was bureau chief in Beijing from 87 to 1995, and in Hong Kong from 1996 until 2000. He was the senior Asia correspondent there. He left in 2006 to become the first Edgerton Fellow there in Los Angeles. He is the author of a newly published book that we'll be talking about, and if you're interested in reading on the subject, you can seek it out. The title of his book is Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. It has just come out recently. Questions are certainly welcome here on this program. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people try to be brief when they call so that we can get in as many different callers as possible, but certainly you're welcome to join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana, across the country if you're listening on the Internet, and that is 800-222-9455. So, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Mr. Chinoy, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Perhaps it might be a good place to start for me to ask you to talk just a little bit about the relationship between North Korea and the United States as it stood at the end of the Clinton administration, so at the point where we were going from the one administration to the from President Clinton to President Bush.
Well, that's actually where my book Meltdown begins. The U.S. and North Korea, of course, had been adversaries for nearly half a century, ever since the Korean War, which led to the United States intervening. And at the end of the Korean War, with the peninsula still divided, the U.S. had 37,000 troops stationed in South Korea, and this was even after the end of the Cold War everywhere else, kind of the last enduring front line of that earlier conflict. But in the waning months of the Clinton administration, The North Koreans sent a very senior envoy to Washington. He met with President Clinton. He delivered a letter from the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-il, inviting Clinton to Pyongyang. And during that visit by this very senior official, Vice Marshal Jo Myon-rok, the North Koreans and the Americans signed a communique in which the two governments agreed that neither one would have, quote, hostile intent toward the other. This was followed by a visit to Pyongyang by Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, hoping to lay the groundwork for a summit meeting in Pyongyang between Bill Clinton and Kim Jong-il. It didn't work out. The main issue at the time was not the nuclear issue, because the North's nuclear program had actually been frozen under a 1994 deal called the Agreed Framework that the Clinton administration had negotiated. It was North Korea's missile program, and the North had and the U.S. had been hoping to reach a deal on that to be sealed by a Clinton visit. But they couldn't reach an agreement, and then time ran out after the disputed 2000 election. And so the Clinton administration left office with momentum for a rapprochement, but they did not conclude the rapprochement. And then the Bush administration came into office and everything changed.
Mm-hmm. Just for a moment to talk a little bit more about the agreed framework. Now, this was an agreement entered into by the two countries, the United States and North Korea. And as I understand it, in the simplest possible terms, what the agreement said was that North Korea would agree not to continue to pursue its own nuclear program. And in exchange, what the United States would do was to assist, and other countries would assist Korea with its energy needs. And it seemed very promising, but then it came apart. And depending upon who you ask, it was either the United States not fulfilling its part, or it was North Korea not fulfilling its part. So I suppose it depends on which side you're on, where you want to point the finger. Why did the agreed framework not succeed?
Well, the agreed framework is very important. People forget now, but I was in both North and South Korea at the time. And in 1994, we came very, very close to a second Korea war. The U.S. was seriously considering military action to take out the North Korean nuclear facility after the North announced it was withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the tensions were very, very high. Then former President Jimmy Carter went to North Korea in June of 1994, and I actually was the only journalist allowed to accompany him. He laid the groundwork for this deal, which was called the Agreed Framework, that was concluded later in 1994. And you're right, the central part of the deal was the North agreed to freeze its plutonium-based nuclear program, and in return was supposed to get both shipments of heavy fuel oil, and there was a promise that an international consortium involving the U.S. and South Korea and Japan would build two light water nuclear reactors, which are considered more proliferation resistant. They don't produce the stuff that can be made into bombs as easily. But it was, for the North Koreans, I think the agreed framework was not just a deal to get energy. It was a kind of political document in which the North hoped would lead to a fundamental change in its relationship with the United States. And one of the things that gets lost, I think, in looking at this is the fact that it seems pretty clear that from the early 90s on, the North Koreans, Kim Il-sung, who was the president until he died, and then his son Kim Jong-il, who succeeded him, they looked around the world. They saw the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fall of communism almost everywhere else, the Chinese embracing market economies and so on. And they felt very isolated, very vulnerable, and they reached the kind of strategic conclusion that in order to ensure the survival of their regime and their system, they had to cut a deal with the United States, and it had to be a deal in which their goal was American recognition and accept and sort of legitimizing them. And in return, they would put their nuclear or missile program on the table to be negotiated away if the price is right. So the North's goal of a political thaw with the U.S. wasn't really realized. It was a kind of a cold peace, in a sense. It was a deal that had a lot of bumps. There was a lot of objection to the agreed framework in Washington, particularly among Republicans, who saw it as a sellout because the U.S. was providing aid to North Korea, and there were delays in the aid because after the Republicans took control of Congress in 1994, they didn't want to appropriate the money. There was a lot of suspicion on the U.S. side about what the North Koreans were doing and signals they might be exploring a possible uranium-based bomb. So it was not very satisfactory, but I think the most important thing, my conclusion is that that deal stopped dead in its tracks the reactor in Yongbyon, which otherwise might have produced enough weapons-grade plutonium for 50 or 100 bombs over the 8 years that it was frozen. And I think that's the central achievement of it. But it was not satisfactory to either side, and as tensions mounted after the Bush administration came into office with a much tougher approach to North Korea, the agreed framework unraveled.
One other question, and then I have a caller that I want to get to. I think that, you know, as people talk about the government of North Korea and what it wants, it is sometimes represented as the, you know, the hermit regime, as if somehow it's not interested in opening to the outside world, and that other people would argue, well, you know, that's not really quite true, that in fact North Korea is interested in normal relations with the United States and with the rest of the world, but on their terms. So then the question becomes, well, what would those terms be? What exactly is that North Korea wants?
Well, I think, I mean, the reality, of course, is when it comes to North Korea, it's a very secretive society, and there are limits to how much any outsider can speak with absolute confidence about their motivations. But I think the evidence based on their statements, on their behavior and so on in recent years is pretty clear that the North wants a thaw with the United States. They don't want the United States to treat it as an enemy, and they calculate that if they can have the world's sole remaining superpower be more friendly to it, that that's the best guarantee of their own security. But at the same time, there's a lot of history here. Going back to the Korean War, the North is very suspicious and wants to be sure that any process of rapprochement is not seen as the North, as the weaker state, the supplicant kind of bowing to the United States. And that partly, I think, explains this consistent North Korean political and diplomatic style of brinksmanship and confrontation and inflamed rhetoric. But I think underneath that, they've been consistent. Their goal is they don't want the United States to treat them like an enemy, and that's the way they calculate they can keep their own very strange, idiosyncratic system worshiping their leader and all of the rest of that intact.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mike Chinoy. He is the Edgerton Fellow on Korean Security at the Pacific Council on International Policy. That's in Los Angeles. Until 2006, he was a foreign correspondent for CNN, largely in Asia, and made many visits to North Korea over the course of nearly two decades. And he's the author of a newly published book, which is titled Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. We have some callers here. We'll start out with someone who is on our toll-free line, the line number 4, right here. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I've recognized your name. I thought I heard you over the news broadcast, Mr. Chinoy, many times, so I'm a little late to the show. So if I ask questions that you've already answered, I hope you'll...
That's no problem. Fire away.
I wondered, since the end of the Korean War, something like 44 Americans have been killed in incidents with North Korea. I wonder if we've done anything to try and calm that area down in the demilitarized zone.
Well, the North Korean demilitarized zone is a very strange place. It is, on the one hand, one of the most tense border demarcation lines anywhere in the world. It's a strip of land, and on one side you have the North Korean military, many of its assets deployed very close to the DMZ. On the other side, you've got the South Korean and the United States militaries. The DMZ itself, no one has lived in it for over 50 years, and so it's actually become something of a kind of nature preserve with all this birds and animals and plant life and so on. It is very tense. And there's always a danger of an accident. The extent to which things happen is to some degree a reflection of the broader political climate. When the general relations or dealings between the U.S. and North Korea, or South Korea and North Korea, are tense or more tense, there's more likely to be trouble, and there is always the danger of a miscalculation.
Well, I understand that just before Desert Storm, the Second War, the Second Gulf War, when North Korea was in our face talking and everything, that they instituted a curfew for the military so that nothing would happen.
Well, I mean, the two sides, there's always a danger of an accident, but the two sides can control it. But I think the DMZ is also a kind of reflection of the fact that the Korean War was ended with an armistice. There's never been a formal peace treaty. The North Koreans, particularly when things are tense, like to point out that the two sides are still technically at war. And one of the broader goals in this diplomatic process that's called the six-party talks has been, in the course of hopefully rolling back the North's nuclear program, the diplomats have talked about a kind of permanent peace regime for Northeast Asia in which the armistice would be replaced by a peace deal, that relations between all the players would be normalized and so on. We're not there yet, but ultimately that's going to have to happen to prevent
I think it's important to point out to the American people, though, that North Korea is not Iraq. If worse came to worse and we got into a Korean War, we would lose a lot more people. We could defeat North Korea. But you're looking at 10,000 to 15,000 American casualties. And
I think you're looking even at more than that. I mean, one of the things that I talk about in my book, Meltdown, the Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis, is that when the Bush administration came to office, there was a tremendous degree of skepticism about the idea of negotiating with North Korea. And there was a push, particularly in the first 6 years of the President Bush's tenure, to pressure North Korea, to look at ways to sanction them, to interdict the shipments of North Korean, you know, missiles that were being sold to other countries, to ratchet up pressure on their financial system and so on. But ultimately, the military option on the Korean Peninsula is a very, very bad one. The U.S. would win a war, but it would be an absolute disaster. The South Korean capital, Seoul, is within easy range of an estimated 10,000 to 12,000 North Korean artillery tubes, chemical weapons, and so on. And so, ultimately, pressure couldn't be backed up by military pressure without unacceptable consequences, and that's always constrained the more hardline approach, because if the North calls your bluff and doesn't back down, then you're left either with not doing anything or taking a military step that would be an absolute catastrophe for the United States and for its key allies in Asia, precisely because the military situation on the peninsula is so volatile.
Yeah, North Korea is in much better shape than the first war. And we lost 54,000 men in that, so there's no telling.
And the North Koreans know that. I mean, they know that with the U.S. bogged down in Iraq and bogged down in Afghanistan, the last thing the United States could afford right now is a new Korean War, especially when the North has repeatedly signaled that if it gets a genuine recognition and legitimacy from the United States, it wants to have an accommodation. And so the military option becomes very problematic.
Okay, thank you very much for talking to me.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
Let's get back to this point where we were as we were moving from the one administration from Presidents Clinton to Bush, because you were talking about the fact that during the Clinton administration, at least the administration was talking with North Korea and was interested in trying to get an improvement in relations to prevent them from developing nuclear weapons. And there was something of a stability, at least in the relationship at that point. When the Bush administration came into office, right out of the box, it's the position it took toward North Korea was very belligerent, and President Bush actually personalized it by the way that he talked about Kim Jong-il, the current leader. So this invites the question, why is it right from the very beginning did the administration take that kind of position?
Well, one of the main themes in the story I recount in Meltdown is the profound divisions that led in many ways to a kind of civil war within the Bush administration over how to deal with North Korea. For people who followed the debates over Iraq and other policies in the Bush administration, it's a similar cast of characters. On the one side, you had the so-called moderates, people like Secretary of State Colin Powell, his deputy Richard Armitage, the professional Asian experts at the State Department. On the other hand, you had the neocons, the hardliners, Vice President Cheney and people who worked for him, John Bolton, who at that early in the Bush administration was Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, Robert Joseph, who was an arms control expert on the National Security Council. These people felt that the agreed framework was a bad deal, that North Korea was such a horrible place that it was morally wrong to have anything to do to them and that to do with them, and that the only appropriate policy was push them and squeeze them, And right from the beginning, there's an episode in my book where the senior officials are meeting to discuss a policy review of the administration's Korea policy, and the moderates wanted to reaffirm this language about the North Koreans and the United States would not have hostile intent toward each other that was in the communique signed when the North Korean general came to Washington while Clinton was still in office. The hardliners said, no, we're not going to reaffirm it, and one of the senior American officials involved in this told me, I talk about it in Meltdown, he said they didn't want to reaffirm no hostile intent because they had hostile intent. They wanted to push North Korea, and then in the wake of 9/11 and in the wake of the successful toppling of the Taliban and the initially apparently successful toppling of Saddam Hussein, it was kind of the high water mark where these folks felt we really can impose our writ on the world and reshape it in the way that we see fit, and therefore the only thing to do with North Korea is to push them, and the only rationale for meeting with them is to discuss the terms of their capitulation. What they didn't realize is that the North Koreans are very capable of pushing back, and their style is if you push them, they'll push back twice as hard, and that's what happened. And that, I think, is the context to see the North Korean nuclear breakout in 2003 when they restarted their nuclear program, and which culminated in them testing a nuclear bomb in 2006.
Yeah. I think if it's possible, it's also useful to at least try to put yourself in the position of the North Koreans as they look at the United States. And from our side, there are a lot of people who think that North Korea is dangerous, it's potentially aggressive, that their interest in having nuclear weapons is for offensive purposes, that you can also, if you try to look at it from the Korean perspective, they may well see the United States as being a threat to them, this kind of belligerent rhetoric, and they might, indeed, you could imagine that they would consider the nuclear weapon something that they would have to have for their defense, and would see this this relationship in a completely different way. In fact, the sort of the mirror opposite from the way that we see it.
Well, it is a bit like going through the looking glass. I've made 14 trips to North Korea, and from the first trip I made in 1989 through to my more recent ones, it's always the same feeling. When you're outside between its very rigid political system, which worships this kind of personality cult around the leader and the regimentation and the very bellicose rhetoric and the martial tone to the place. But when you're there, it looks rather different. It's a country that sees itself, it's surrounded by big neighbors, China, Japan, and Russia, all of whom at one point or another they've had hostile relationships. It's a country that was flattened during the Korean War, that saw all of its communist allies change or disappear in the 1990s, that's desperately concerned about its own survival, that knows that it's an economic basket case, that is really very, very concerned. And so they had this movement towards a thaw with the U.S. at the end of the Clinton administration, and then you have a group of people come in who say, talking to North Korea is bad in principle, we should push them. And then if you're North Korea and you watch the first 3 years of the Bush administration, you had the Axis of Evil speech followed by the invasion of Iraq and the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the articulation by President Bush of this doctrine of preemption, that the U.S. had the right to move preemptively against countries that it thought might be a threat. So if you're North Korea, there's the old joke, even paranoids have enemies. If you're Kim Jong-il sitting there watching that, what's the conclusion? And I've had North Koreans say to me explicitly, boy, we were right to develop nuclear weapons. Saddam Hussein didn't have them, and look what happened to him, and we're going to make sure that Kim Jong-il doesn't suffer the same fate. And I think that fed a North Korean sense of paranoia and shattered what little initial trust had begun to develop at the end of the Clinton administration. And part of the problem now is there's no trust. And the North Koreans, even though the Bush administration reversed course in late 2006 and you've had some progress on the diplomatic front, fundamentally the North Koreans don't really believe that the Bush administration is serious about wanting to coexist with it. And they parse every presidential statement, every statement by Secretary of State Rice, for clues, and they don't often see statement saying, yes, we're willing to be friends with North Korea. So this feeds their sense that we better be prepared in case. And I think, frankly, if you talk about some of the current difficulties in the negotiating process, which we could get to, that is part of the reason for explaining North Korean behavior.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mike Chinoy. He is the Edgerton Fellow on Korean Security at the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles. He's been reporting on Asia as a journalist for nearly 30 years. He worked for CNN for 24 years. He served as their bureau chief in Beijing and also in Hong Kong. He is the author of a newly published book, and the title is Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Questions are welcome. We have a couple of people standing by here ready to go. We'll start in with Urbana and line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? I've enjoyed your work over the years. On the Korean issue, I think in a sense the Bush administration likes to have that form of enemy, but whether they're paranoid is that they are. But I wanted to ask you about the test you mentioned. I'd read through the scientific literature and in the popular press, the test that they made a few years back was not really was a failure. It wasn't actually a complete explosion. And I wanted to know if you knew anything about that. But also, you're right about them being a basket case. I know South Korea and the United States feed them or send food to them. I don't know if the elite get all of it or not. I mean, you've been there. You might know that. But also, I wanted to ask you about North Korea's relationship with the Kon network, which disseminated, proliferated nuclear materials around the Middle East and South Africa, I guess, years back. But also I wanted to ask in reference to the Syrian reactor or fake reactor or building that was blown up, the insinuation I got from the New York Times and from the literature I'd read in the European press was that reactor looked very similar to the reactors in North Korea. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, that's a lot of things to comment on. Let me start at the end and work backwards here. On the issue of Syria, you refer to an episode in which in September of 2007, Israel destroyed a facility in the Syrian desert, which, according to subsequent leaks, appears to have been a project to build a nuclear reactor, which widely suspected to have been modeled on the North Korean reactor being built with North Korean help. That certainly seems to be the case. This is a fascinating episode because the information about it has been very, very closely held, and there's still a lot of mystery about it. Its immediate relevance is that after this episode happened, the United States added a demand in its negotiations with North Korea that as part of any North Korean declaration of its nuclear capabilities, which the North committed to provide under an agreement reached in February of 2007, they had to come clean on Syria, and the North was very reluctant to do so, and there were disputes in Washington over how hard to press the North Koreans and whether the North's unwillingness to be forthcoming now should preclude American positive responses to other things the North Koreans were doing that would allow the disabling of the North Korean reactor to go ahead. I think the point here is we still don't know a lot, but the immediate threat appears to have been taken care of when the Israelis turned that facility into a pile of rubble on the ground. North Korea's relationship with the nuclear proliferation network run by the rogue Pakistani nuclear scientist AQ Khan is a very, very interesting one. The North Korean-Pakistani cooperation in this area goes back to the early 90s. The North Koreans had a missile capability, which the Pakistanis, who were developing a nuclear capability, didn't have. And it's still kind of murky precisely what happened. It is known that AQ Khan made, by some accounts, up to 13 trips to North Korea. Former Pakistani President Musharraf has confirmed that Khan provided a small number of centrifuges to the North Koreans, sort of prototypes that would help them understand how to enrich uranium. So there was unquestionably contact. It remains unclear whether this was Khan doing this on his own for money, whether this was part of a broader Pakistani-North Korean network of military cooperation. They unquestionably got stuff from Pakistan. It does not appear they got enough to actually make a fully fledged uranium enrichment capability. And for all of the public concern about a North Korean uranium program, all of the research I did for my book Meltdown suggested that whatever they were doing, they never got to the point where they could actually manufacture uranium, and that they were years away from it. On the question of food, the North is in terrible shape on the food front, and this year is particularly bad. They have been getting food from South Korea, and they have been getting food from the United States. It's a horrible situation for ordinary North Koreans. The political question is the situation so bad as to produce changes in a positive way in North Korea's external behavior? And my guess is probably not. This is a regime that in the mid-1990s let nearly 2 million people, 2 million of its own people, starve to death. So I think that as miserable as the plight of ordinary North Koreans is, it's not going to necessarily make the North Koreans suddenly be easier to deal with. I think you had one more question, but I can't remember what it was.
It was about the test and whether it was
test,
a success or not.
The nuclear test was not, as best I could tell in researching Meltdown, was not, you know, a full-fledged success. But what it did show is that the North Koreans could put weapons-grade plutonium into something and blow it up, and that made the political point that they had that technological capability. It's not clear that this was a, you know, there were many, many issues, but I think the nuclear test was to a large degree intended as a political gesture as much as a military gesture, and it, because if you look, and I write about this at great length in Meltdown, the sort of back story to this was that the North had been trying for more than a year to get two things from the United States in late 2005 and 2006. Number one, you may remember the United States had imposed sanctions on a bank in the former Portuguese colony of Macau next to Hong Kong, the Banco Delta Asia, where the North Koreans had accounts. The North Koreans wanted action to resolve that issue, and the U.S. wouldn't do it. And then the North Koreans were asking for a bilateral meeting between its senior negotiator and the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, Christopher Hill, and the hardliners in Washington wouldn't allow that. And it was against that backdrop that the North got increasingly frustrated and, true to form, stage a nuclear test to make the point, you don't talk to us, we can create trouble. And interestingly, within a month of the test, the North got both a bilateral meeting and a promise from the U.S. to deal with this bank in Macau, and within 4 months they had this February 2007 deal that's underpinned the positive steps we've seen since.
I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping here. We're getting into our last less than 20 minutes. We have some other callers and want to go on. We'll next go to Champaign County, and this is line number two. Hello.
Apropos Khan, David, you've had a British guy on who researched the kind of the winking that the U.S. did during the Reagan era at the collusion of Khan with a variety of actors. I don't know if it was North Korea at the time, but that's the proliferation seems to be useful when it does something politically and diplomatically that the U.S. wants to do, and other than that, it doesn't seem to be as high a priority as one might think it should be. The whole context of the North Korean impasse and the fact that it's armistice and not a peace treaty makes me think of the surprise I had. The local paper here had a two-part expose of Nogun Ri, the slaughter of Koreans, and it wasn't quite divided. Well, of course it was, but it was a very recent division. On the 4th of July holiday time, it was absolutely astonishing to see that this was this was coming up. I've heard a figure that 30% of the population of North Korea was killed during the Korean War. I don't know if that's accurate, if anybody really knows, but that is an astonishing figure. And anybody that doesn't think that that would promote some paranoia in a society for many, many decades can't apparently put themselves in the position of having, you know, 30% of your population killed. So,
well, you make an interesting point, and one of the things that I was struck on my last trip to North Korea, I was taken to a couple of different places where our guides talked at length about the damage inflicted on and destruction inflicted on North Korea during the war. And they took us to this very attractive temple, which had survived the war, but they made a point, the first thing they showed us were the bullet holes from the fighting. So there's no question. I mean, North Korea was quite literally flattened by the war. It was an extraordinarily traumatic event. I think it's fair to say that the North Korean regime has manipulated and used that fact to consolidate its own control, to inculcate a degree of antipathy towards the United States that served its political purposes. But underneath that, it's very real. One of the more revealing anecdotes that I write about in Meltdown comes at the end of the book. One of the final scenes is the Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill making his first visit in December of 2007 to the Yongbyon nuclear reactor. And he meets with the senior official at the reactor. And the official says, you know, you have to understand, Mr. Hill, that this is more than just shutting down a facility. We've got 50 years of an attitude towards you that we have to learn how to change. And Hill, in recounting this episode to me, said that the thought crossed his mind that that's equally true in the United States, that the legacy of that conflict endures in a way that it doesn't in many other parts of the world.
Yeah, well, I had a high school history instructor who was a veteran, and people remember Vietnam, but Korea was shorter and much more bloody in a shorter period of time, so it was devastating to a lot of the vets. So I understand that. You mentioned about parsing the Bush administration's language, looking as to whether North Koreans might be friends or there be any implication of that. I think there isn't even any language that says that the U.S. wants to really be some kind of constructive adversaries as opposed to friends.
Well, one of the issues here has been that the Bush administration has had very, very mixed signals from different players. The president himself famously told the Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward that he, quote, loathed Kim Jong-il, and I think that's deep down how he feels. But the president, you know, sort of, there's, and I write about this a lot in Meltdown, there's a conflict between President Bush's head and his heart on North Korea, you know, or his gut and his head. I mean, in his heart, in his gut, he hates these people. He thinks they're just absolute monsters, and they treat their people horribly, and it's one of the worst regimes on the face of the earth. And then in his head, he realizes he can't just go in and whack them like he did with Saddam Hussein. And part of the inconsistency of the signals from the Bush administration has been the fact that the president himself goes back and forth. And so earlier on, you just had these very hostile statements. Then they would be tempered by statements saying, oh, we have no intention to attack North Korea. And then in the deal that was reached in February of 2007 that has underpinned the rollback, the partial rollback of their nuclear program that we've seen since then, the U.S. did talk about establishing normal relations with North Korea and establishing a final peace regime on the Korean peninsula. But more recently, for example, the president gave a speech in Bangkok on his way to the Beijing Olympics, and the references to North Korea there talked about how we are in the process of dismantling the North's nuclear program, and there wasn't a single reference to we, in the context of establishing a new and more positive normal relationship with North Korea, are seeking the dismantling. It's the president's sort of default position. His instinct on North Korea is to be tough. And the North Koreans, who are very sensitive and who see this in a broader political context, when they parse the language, they see demands for this and demands for that, and only very occasionally statements that when this is all done, we can, in fact, have a civilized relationship, and that makes them suspicious.
Again, I hope the caller won't mind if I go to another. This is Champagne in line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
What about the, it's great to have an expert on, you know, without all the spin, about South Korean, you know, the people, from my understanding, I don't think it gets any play here, but in terms of the American soldiers, the way the South Koreans are treated, I think, weren't a number of them killed, that kind of thing, or is that just public relations or what?
I'm not clear at what point you're what?
There was a display here on campus by an artist, and it showed the people in terms of, in other words, what happened, soldiers, in other words, American soldiers, in terms of where people were hurt, people were killed, and they really didn't have any any rights in that regard. I don't know.
There are many different periods. I mean, going back to the Korean War, there's all sorts of horrible things that happened in the Korean War. South Korea, you bring up an interesting point, though. South Korea and the U.S. have a very important and extremely complicated relationship. On the one hand, we are allies. The U.S. has a security treaty with South Korea. If North Korea ever attacked South Korea, the U.S. would come to its aid. On the other hand, the South Koreans are now hugely successful, the world's 13th largest economy. They've kind of grown up, and there's a degree of unease or discomfort at having this kind of big brother relationship with the United States when they want to stand on their own feet. And for much of the Bush administration, there was a real disconnect because the South Koreans, until this past February when a new president was inaugurated, the two previous presidents had pursued rapprochement with North Korea, the so-called sunshine policy of engaging with the North. And during much of the Bush administration, President Bush was very skeptical of that approach. And so the two sides were very out of sync about how to deal with North Korea, and that caused real damage to U.S.-South Korea relations and to the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Now you have a new president in South Korea who's somewhat more conservative and somewhat more skeptical of North Korea, which, on the one hand, American officials welcome that he's not what they see as kind of a woolly-headed, naive dreamer about North Korean intentions. On the other hand, he's much more skeptical of North Korea than what American policy in the last many months has been in terms of the U.S. has been pursuing dialogue and negotiations on the nuclear front when the South Korean president has been more skeptical. So you have a kind of ironic role reversal, which also creates problems. So it's a very, very, it's a hugely important relationship and very complicated one to manage.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Mike Chinoy. He is former foreign correspondent for CNN, doing most of his reporting from Asia. He is now Edgerton Fellow on Korean Security at the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles. He's author of the recent book Meltdown, the inside story of the North Korean nuclear crisis. Here we have about 7-8 minutes left. I want to make sure that we talk about where we are now, particularly the very significant, what seems to be a significant reversal of policy after something like 6 years of the Bush administration being very adamant about not dealing with North Korea, saying we won't talk to a regime like this, and the only time we'll talk to them is when it comes time to accept their surrender. Within the last year and a half, there has been a significant change that seems to be positive, although there seems to be a lot of ups and downs in this effort to try to persuade North Korea not to develop or not to go further than they have in developing nuclear weapons. What happened to bring about this significant change as far as the course the United States was taking?
Well, that's one of the most dramatic sections of Meltdown, was trying to reconstruct the internal deliberations that led to this absolutely astonishing about-face on the part of the Bush administration. There were several factors, I think, that went into it. One was the appointment of Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill to be the sort of main point person on North Korea. Hill, in the 1990s, had been deputy to Richard Holbrooke in negotiating the Dayton Accords that ended the Bosnian conflict and had a reputation for being able to negotiate with bad guys. And when he was brought in, he said to Condoleezza Rice, basically, if I'm going to take this job, I have to be able to talk to these people. But it wasn't until after North Korea tested its nuclear bomb that the center of gravity really shifted in Washington. It became clear that confrontation was a dead-end street. That coincided in November of 2006 with the Democrats taking control of Congress in what was clearly a nationwide repudiation of the sort of hardline Republican foreign policy approach, which produced a significant weakening of Vice President Cheney's position and an opening for Hill, who convinced Rice, who then convinced the president, that given the apparent failure of so many of the other of the administration's foreign policy initiatives, there was a chance of a deal on North Korea. Hill himself is a very interesting and colorful character. He consistently defied or ignored instructions, stretched his guidance from Rice to hold meetings privately with the North Koreans when he wasn't supposed to, and so on. Part of this effort of reestablishing trust and convincing the North Koreans they had a partner they could deal with. So the upshot was an agreement in February of 2007 that laid out in quite a lot of detail a series of steps under which the North would disable its nuclear facilities and get aid in the form of fuel oil shipments and other kinds of aid, and then agree to submit a declaration of its nuclear capabilities, after which the U.S. promised to take North Korea off its list of states sponsoring terrorism. And there were a lot of ups and downs, you're right, but since then, the North has in fact stopped operations of the Yongbyon facility. There was a very highly public episode in the summer where they invited CNN and other TV crews in to watch them blow up the cooling tower. They've got American experts there. They have been, you know, sawing, you know, metal chains in half and padlocking things and taking things apart. So there has been significant progress, but it's been very up and down, and there are a lot of difficulties. And right now, we're actually at a point where the North they're in a dispute over the fact that the U.S. has not actually taken the North off its terrorism list, despite announcing its intention to do so. And the North has now said that it is going to put the disabling of the reactor on pause. So this is a very bumpy process, which could still go wrong. But there has been a lot of progress made since early 2007.
Well, do you think now in the waning days of this administration that it is possible for something significant to happen here, or that for some significant change to occur, that's going to have to wait until we have another, whoever it is, another administration?
Well, the signs are not particularly promising at the moment. The North gave this declaration at the end of June, which was accepted by the United States and the other members of the six-party talks, and in response, the Bush administration announced that it was going to take North Korea off the terrorism list. But then Washington said that it would not actually implement that decision until the North Koreans agreed to a very detailed verification protocol, so that the U.S. had a mechanism to actually verify what the North said in this 60-page declaration, which has not yet been made public. The North Koreans were very angry at this because they point out that, in fact, in these agreements in February of 07 and a subsequent one in October of 07, there is no specific reference to a verification protocol. And so they say that by insisting on this verification protocol now, rather than lifting the terrorism designation and working on verification later, the U.S. has kind of moved the goalposts. And I think this is partly because the declaration itself does not cover a lot of issues that Washington has concerns about. It's partly also politics in Washington and not wanting to appear to be giving too much to the North Koreans. But the North is now signaling that if the U.S. is not going to move ahead, that it has the ability to halt, you know, to stop the process dead in its tracks. I'm told by sources who are close to this that this is not yet a showstopper, that there are still negotiations going on. They might find a way around it, but I think this is not going to get solved in the remaining months of the Bush administration, and whoever comes into office is going to have to make a major decision about what to do, how to move this forward, and to deal with the North Koreans, who are difficult customers, no question about it.
Well, certainly we would expect that the two potential administrations here, Republican Democratic, would take a different approach. And of course, you don't really know what the conditions will be at the time. But having said all that, have either Senators McCain or Obama said anything concrete and direct about how they would manage this situation were they to be president?
Yeah, both campaigns have spoken on this issue. Senator McCain has been very hardline on North Korea, going back to the earliest days of the agreed framework. In some ways, he's been more hawkish than President Bush, and he and the many of his chief Asia policy advisors are very skeptical of this whole process. They kind of argue that the U.S. has given North Korea more than North Korea has given the United States, although my personal view is I don't agree with that. The North Koreans have actually moved a long way towards shutting down something that can make nuclear bombs, and what the U.S. has done is given them some fuel oil and possibly take them off a list. But there is a lot of suspicion about that. So I think if a McCain administration took office, there might well be a very serious consideration of, you know, not pursuing this in the same way, although that has enormous risks, including the North restarting the program and we're back to square one. The Obama campaign has been somewhat more supportive, but it too has been a little bit skeptical about this process, whether that's because they're uncomfortable saying too many positive things about anything that the Bush administration is doing, whether they also have some genuine doubts about how forthcoming the North Koreans have been. In either case, though, between the mere process of transition and the fact that a new administration will have a policy review and it will take months to get the new players in place, this will go on hold for a while. And if it goes on hold in a situation where there's a lot of ill will and the North is saying it's going to stop this disabling or might restart the whole reactor again if they don't get what they want, it's not inconceivable that by this time next year, we'll have round three of the North Korean nuclear crisis bubbling away.
You've had the opportunity that not a lot of journalists or Americans have, and that is to travel in North Korea, and have been there a number of times and have been following politics there over some period of time. I'm particularly interested in your impressions of the current leader, Kim Jong-il, and whether, in fact, in what is said about him and reported about him often gives an impression that's just not true, not the case.
Well, there is a caricature of Kim Jong-il that he's kind of this whacked-out guy with his bouffant hairdo and his platform shoes who likes to swill cognac and has a collection of 20,000 movies and sort of erratic, strange guy. But in the course of researching Meltdown, I interviewed many people who had met him, both Americans and South Koreans, including people who spent hours with him. They give a very different impression. They say that this is a very smart, shrewd operator. He's well-briefed. He's well-informed. He's decisive. He's in charge. He's calculating. By definition, anybody who presides over a system as idiosyncratic and strange as North Korea's, it's understandable people raise questions about. But that aside, he's not a maniac. He's a guy whose goal is to ensure the survival of his regime. He leads a system that feels itself weak and beleaguered and surrounded and endangered by the United States, and he's willing to be friendly when it's appropriate, and he's willing to make very menacing noises when it's appropriate to make the point, we're willing to deal, but don't mess with us.
There, we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Mike Chinoy, he's the Edgerton Fellow on Korean Security at the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles, and until 2006, he was a foreign correspondent for CNN, largely in Asia, and has had the chance to make many visits to North Korea over the course of nearly two decades. He is the author of the recently published book, Meltdown, the Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis. It's published by the St. Martin's Press. Mr. Chinoy, thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
The broadcast today is made possible in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, experienced full-time professional agents listing and selling homes in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. A little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, a chance to call in and talk about how things grow in the yard now that we're getting to the end of the summer. U of I horticulturalist Diane Noland and Chuck Voigt will be the guests. And any questions you have, I'm taking care of things that grow around the home landscape, you're welcome to call. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Coming up in the next part of this show, we'll be talking about current developments in Pakistan and India, and our guest will be Steve Cohen. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. So stay with us. Right now, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, for an update on news and the markets.
And at 10:59 with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The wheat market has turned sharply lower on better weather across the world. Corn and soybeans have tended to follow the wheat lower after a rally earlier today on higher oil prices. But looking at better weather domestically as well. So that's weighing on the markets as we head into the 11 o'clock hour. September wheat in Kansas City down 27¾ cents right now at 838 a bushel. Dece wheat in Kansas City, 862, down 26. In Chicago, in the CME Group wheat board, September is down 24½ cents at 806. December, 825½, down 29. March at 850, down 28¼. In the corn, the nearby September is at 573½ a bushel, down a penny and three quarters. December corn is at 592, down 2. March, 611, down 2½. May corn, 621, down 5. In the bean complex, September is at 1328, down 9½ cents. November soybeans at 1342½, down 2. January at 1359, down 3. The March, though, up 2¼ at 1378. Bean meal for September is at 365.50, down 170. September bean oil at 53.90, down 2. On the livestock side, August live cattle down.